Mr. Hayes.
Reel 10.
We were talking about after this mission you were sent off with HE ammunition up to this quarry position.
So, apparently what I was supposed to do, when I was directed in there, was to back onto one of the tanks that were up on the ridge, you know, firing. And instead of them taking it from their bins within the tank, I was supposed to back onto one of the tanks, whichever they wanted me to do. And I would help them, you know, get on the back of the line and load the ammunition across the back of the tank. You put something on the back of the tank to load it onto the turret as they needed. Tell this a bit early, but nevertheless, you're told to do these things. So anyway, when I got up there, I drove into this quarry sort of thing, and it was tippering down the bay, from what I remember. And in the centre of the group was, I assumed, was the colonel. And I gasped his ground sheet over his shoulder, and he was straight at this. And I couldn't swear to it to this day, but it seemed to me that he was crying his eyes out, the amount of men he'd lost, which, you know, really shook me rigid, because I didn't know how many they'd lost. And whoever it was in there said, "No, we don't need you, return to your unit. We're moving on shortly." So I said, okay. So I came down the road, back to where the bridge was, with a view of turning left to join the vehicles that were there. And as I got to that point, just by the bridge, the sergeant that was in the ditch there goes to me, goes like this, you know, stop, turn round, and stop. So anyway, oh, I did have some jewelry in the corporal coroner had with me. And I did this manoeuvre and dived out the truck and got in the ditch. So I never thought of him. He said, "Now, you will see our vehicles from further up the ridge come down and go over to our, is it over to be their left?" Because he said, "We're moving on, somebody else is taking over." So I said, okay. So anyway, he said, "Now, as soon as I give you the aye-aye," because he said, "I'll watch the traffic moving, you get onto the end of that convoy." So, and Corporal Cullen, he was the other side of the road, but he'd heard what was going on, and he was ready to, you know, leap up once we get the word done. So he said to me, "Right, go on." So I got into the wagon, and I looked for, you know, the automatically looked like that, and there was a bullet hole straight through my windscreen, where I'd just got out of, and it would, if I'd have been sitting there, I'd have been a goner. I didn't wait for Corporal Cullen, he's still sitting there as far as I knew. I just switched on, put my foot down, dumped it down the gun. Well, I don't know what happened to him, I wasn't going to wait for him in case he took him. How the hell anybody got on the top of that ridge and was firing towards that bridge? I don't know.
It was a sniper.
It probably was, you're probably right, but that didn't reassure me if I was not going to have a second sniper at me. So anyway, that was that little episode. It was a muddy sort of thing, that thing. They had very high losses, that unit. And as I say, one of the corporals got a VC out of that. And apparently, one of the fellows I was talking to when we went back after the war to the anniversary, the 50th anniversary, I think, of the relief of Fleur, and was talking to one of his mates, and he said, "No," he said, "he's still all right," he said, "and he always turns out when we have any dues," and he's, you know, he said, "he doesn't, nothing phases him," you know, he said, "he doesn't want these sort of things, one of these people, I'm ashamed of." No, he said, "he would turn up," and he said, "he was a very, very nice fellow." But, so that was that episode. And then, where do we go from there?
When shortly after you went near Belsen, were you aware of that?
That was a funny story, too. We didn't know where Belsen was. It was I found that now. It was somewhere near Cell, CELLE. And what had happened was, one of the units that sussed it out was a strange name of a unit called Todd Force. Now, Todd Force was a 25-pounder unit that had just towed 25-pounders. And also some 25-pounders on Shermans. It was a split regiment. So when they were going up into Germany, he said, "We won't get," they were assuming that it was going to be quite a long thing, "we won't get time to stop and set our guns up. So we said, what we'll do, we'll put those 25 pounders from that particular, I've got the name of the regiment somewhere, and it was a name that had been a young regiment of some sort, because they had a habit of, the guns, what did they call it, field guns and that sort of thing, they were named with such and such a number. But they also probably came from a yeomanry regiment, and they had a habit of every now and again quoting that instead of artillery regiment, as you should say. So what they did, they said, well, we'll take the 25 pounds and put them into store, and we will get a muck from the men we've got there. We will have an extra company of infantry. And they weren't shy about, you know, giving them a different job. So they said, well, what are we going to call them? So the name of the colonel was Colonel Todd. So they called it Todd Force. And they used them for, not for set pit battles, but if they get to a bridge or an area that had to be monitored, they would put Todd Force off there as sentry duty, really. But they, unfortunately, ended up with a sticky job of doing mainly the police force within Belsen. Because actually, if I hadn't known what I was looking for, because every time these Belsen programmes used to come, I had a habit of watching them, and I could see that these fellows were an artillery regiment, but carrying rifles, and they were part of Todd Force. And they stayed in there. I don't know how many were actually inside there, but they stayed there for about, I don't know how many months.
Now, did you lock any of your unit going?
Nope. The third tanks went up and guarded the gates. Didn't go inside. The ones that went inside were there. And I thought, where the hell did they suddenly appear from? They were German-speaking German Jews, by and large. Because we got a lot of them when we got into that side of Watson. They came across as field security police, actually. But they were interpreters as well. So they were the ones that went in, and the ones that you see them, even Belsen, all footage from that, you see them walking around with a pistol at the belt. And it said the 53rd, and I thought, 53rd? That was the number of our regiment. But it wasn't 53rd Regiment, it was 53rd Field Security Police. And they're the ones that would give you the impression, anybody didn't know, they'd fought all the way up from the beaches, but they ain't. They'd been brought in because of the, you know, they were German, they were basically German Jews that had been, and we had one with us, Sergeant Marks, and he'd been evacuated to this country in about 1937-38. And they virtually finished their education in England. And when the time came for them to be called up, instead of putting them in the ordinary army, they put them in. But in our case, with our regiment, he'd be the cap badge and everything of our regiment. Sergeant Marks, he was a nice fella. And anyway, we got up near there this particular night, and can't remember where we were, and we were in this field. But prior to going up there, we'd had the first time we'd been issued with what the American pub tents, which was either a one-man tank or a one-man tent or 2 men at a push, and a brand spanking new these. And we got up there into this field, and whoever it was in charge said, "Don't," because what we used to do was make for the nearest house we could find, and so have a bit of comfort. So, and I was always the cheeky one and said, "Well, one of the officers going to sleep in when you say we don't sleep in ours because of the threats of typhoid." I said, "Have they all been injected for typhoid? Don't be cheeky." So anyway, we were in there and it was getting dark.
What were these little tents like?
They were beautifully made tents, and they'd only be about that high when you set them up out. And a couple of pegs and splayed out like that, straight from a ridge about that high down to the ground. I guess you'd have kept all mine actually. Oh, I must have handled it in at some time. So anyway, it was just getting dusk, and the sergeant, whoever, it was still with the sailor next one, he came and he said to me, "Do you got a chat, Ian?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, go down that road there, and you'll see a bit of a battle going on." It was, the village was erupting. And anyway, I said, "Okay." So ask him what they want. And while you're down there, now this is the part where I did make a mistake. Take this and give it to the crews down there. And he gave me a gallon Chardon rum. And I forgot to give it to him when I was got down there. I was foolish enough to give it to him back when I got back. So anyway, when we got down there, when I got down there, I should say, and I pulled into where this village on the coast, and he said, "What are you doing down here?" I said, "Oh, we brought some HE for him." And he said, "Well, we don't need it, you can go back." I said, "Oh, okay." So on the way back, it was pitch black, because the burning village was then behind me, and it was going into black abyss. And on the way, part way down, I could see infantry coming up towards me, and it would be our infantry that would come up when it got dark to consolidate and give a support to the tanks, you know, that put out pickets for the tanks. And part way down the road, and I never heard, I know what I had, I hit a half track, and I hit it with a right bang on me, with my left hand wheel, my right hand wheel. Anyway, I didn't stop to see what damage had been done. I thought, if any damage, it's going to be to my line. So anyway, I got down back into the lager. I said, "Oh, they don't need me, for they're all about the room." And somebody said to me, a couple of days later, "I'll give it back to my dad," but he never got it back. I didn't like rum. Anyway, that was beside the point. So anyway, the next one, I said, "Right, the first light, we're moving over the bridge. And there's only you lot going over the bridge, and then we're going to blow the bridge behind you." Oh, that wasn't very good. Well, what's the reason for that? Well, in case they do get out from Belsen, they'd make for that particular bridge. Okay, so got stuck onto the road, and I drove about 20 yards and suddenly realised the lock either right or left didn't exist. I'd knocked the axle back on this thing, you know, on this armoured half track that I had. So I thought, well, it's no good, you know, kidding on this one. So I said, whether it was a sandwich, I said, "I have got no right lock or left lock, whatever it was." "Oh, yeah, you know." So I said, "Well, you can try it yourself. I've just gone not one left, either right or left." And I got left locked to one, but nothing to whichever way. And I thought, well, this is going to be good if we get across this bridge, and I'm stuck there. And the idea was they were going to go across the bridge with a minimum number of people that they actually needed for the day. And we, when they got there, we were going to go left and down the road another way to another bridge. And they would blow that bridge behind the first lot that went over. So anyway, I went back. Then there was a panic as to unload my wagon onto somebody else's. So eventually that was done, and I was stuck there. Anyway, fortunately there was a fitter troop in the next farm, and my brother was one of them that was on it. So I walked on to him and said, I like this idea of brotherly love. And he said, "What the bloody hell are you doing here?" So I said, "Well, I've got no lock." "Oh, just when there's good pickings up there, watches and cameras, and you decide to bail out, do you?" I said, "Well, that's not a very nice Christian attitude, is it, for a bowler?" So he said, "No." Well, I said, "While I'm here," I said, "you fix this." I don't know when they did or when they had to send it back to further. I said, "I've got a little pistol here, Italian, like a woman's pistol." It was a beautiful little thing. It was only about that long. And I said, "I've broken one of the pins in it. Can you think you can fix it for me?" Now, they were on the back of the stores truck. So I gave it to him. And I don't know what made me do it, and what made him do the same thing. And he took it off me and put it back. He said, "They're working now, all right." And I was standing there, and he goes, bang! And he said, "You didn't tell me it was loaded." I said, "You didn't ask." It was a beautiful little pistol, well, you know, sort of automatic. It was almost like a lady's, it was an Italian thing. And I don't know how I'd have explained that away, you know, in the regimental history, you know, only a man can shoot at his own brother with the brother's gun. I mean, we shouldn't have had it to start with. But anyway, that went okay. So eventually, so what we did then, as I say, we didn't get up to Belsen, right up to Belsen, but we went the other way around. But what? And I'm reading from, I'm repeating from Pip Roberts's memoirs now. What he did, and I admired him for what he did. He got hold of all the B vehicle people. Said, well, anything we don't need, immediately, offload it. I've got a job for you. And, you know, it was some that he did. And they went round all the villages in the area within 10 miles and got hold of the burgomaster and said, right, everybody in the village on the back of that wagon. And they ran them up to Belsen. And they were running to Belsen, and he said, now get out and walk around and see what your people have been doing to these people. And he actually did it. He never heard any mention of any other thing but his memoirs.
Did you do some of that?
No, I didn't. I don't know why. Well, I was an A1. It was a BS thing they were talking about. Because there was a water fight at the same time. But the story about Belsen, people don't realise. And I didn't realise at the time. And I didn't know for years after. When we got to this next river line, which was, I don't know what it was, but it was a very well-known one. And I've got it somewhere in the book. And I could pinpoint it because I know the last fella I buried was up in the rise there from it.
Was this the last casualty?
No, well, the last one I took part in, Stan Bush.
Oh, yes, he was the last one.
Yeah, well, that was it. That was the last one I buried.
What do you remember of that?
Well,
the burial, I mean.
Well, actually.
Or the circumstance, the whole thing. Because he was killed on round about the 19th of April.
Yeah, well, that would be the time then. But because they were trying to. They sent Stukas over to try and knock the bridge out. And weren't having a great deal of success with him. At that particular time, Stan came back that Stan Bush had been killed. And, body him, and he said, will you come and help? He never said, will you come and bury it? But, you know, he said, can you come and help out on a burial? And I always used to go on, but it was the one thing that really struck me because I knew Stan very well.
What was he like?
He was a nice guy. Very quiet, nice human. But it really was, and I mentioned it at the Watson, and they said, oh yeah, I remember him. You know, he stood out as a nice guy. And I had a feeling he was, I think I remember he was a corporal or a sergeant.
He was a corporal, yeah.
And I think he was in charge of a tank as well. Because that was possible. Anyway,
what do you remember of of that particular burial? Just because it's the last one, I just wonder if you remembered it.
I can't remember him actually. I know you lose track as time goes on, you know, because you didn't come into day to day basis. But I remember the brother Stan was very funny with Stan Bush. And that they tried their damnedest to blow this bridge. Anyway, while we were there at that particular time, when things quieted down a bit and they got the bridge across, somebody said to me, what the hell is this coming along? And it was a convoy of three tunnels. And on the back of it were Germans. And, you know, myths were formed that these people, mainly in Belsen, were Hungarians. I read it was true, I don't know. But anyway, they'd had, and you must have read it somewhere, about the local troops in the Belsen. And what had actually happened was, the Germans had sent embassies, or whatever they called, under white flag to meet our people. Just got to this river line by Belsen. And they said, would they let the army that was in place there, nothing to do with Belsen, and that's why they were coming forward, could we, if we withdrew behind Belsen and leaving Belsen virtually in your charge, would it be okay? So, whoever was in charge at the time said, we can't give you that answer. You'd have to go back to brigade. And there were three German officers. And when they got there, they said, well, they listened to it very carefully, and they said, this doesn't sound very good to us because we would actually be firing with our artillery over Belgium, and we're not very prepared to do that. And so, and there was a lot of haggling. And so, and in the end, the brigadier said, "Right," he said, "we'll come up with a compromise." He said, "We'll arrange a local truce."
Now, you wouldn't have known any of this at the time,
no,
though,
I didn't, but I found out after, because, and it explained why these people were getting put across the river. And I thought there were people out of the camp, but they weren't. There was about 300 of them, German, in strength, of German troops. Wehrmacht, as we like to call them. And they said, "What we'll do, we'll put you into an area, and you'll be under a truce obligation then. And when the Belsen situation is cleared, the truce will be broken, and we'll put you, the whole lot of you, back across that next river," which were the ones we saw going across.
So you saw them being evacuated?
I saw them going across the river. But they said, "There's going to be..." And they said, "Well, you know." So they said, "Yeah." He said, "You go, we'll tell you when, but up to now, you're only going on a local truce," which was very popular. So there could have been as many as 300 of these people. So when it came to Belsen being, you know, cleared, or secured, should we say, they said to these Germans, "Now, right, we're going to cross the river." And almost to a man, I think it was only 16 that said, want to go. They said, "Oh, no, they realised they weren't going to get their throats cut by our people. So they decided they want to surrender there and then." And they said, "Oh, no, you arrange for the truce and you can't suddenly break it." He said, "No, at some point in the minute, we will pick you up in our trucks and we'll take you across the river. But you won't get your weapons back immediately. We'll drop them halfway back to the bridge." And they worked out the timing about where they could get to the bridge and something. But he said, "Rest assured, there's none of you opting out and saying, now you're going to be a prisoner of war because you're not on. You're under local truce and this, you have to abide by the rules." And these were the people we saw going across on the bridge. I don't know whether they're Hungarians or not, because they all had German hats on, obviously. Not tin hats, but, you know, soft hats. And I didn't know till after the war what Belsen was all about. Not a thing. I'd then been finishing the service there and gone to the 5th Tanks, and then it started to filter through to about what Belsen really was.
Now, anything else happened before the end of the war? Because you're getting quite close there. That's towards the end of April.
Yeah. We eventually ended up in... Schleswig-Holstein.
What about a couple more things? I mean, there was a sort of dash along the motorway.
Oh, yes, yeah. Because
what do you remember that?
Yeah, it was, and how. Because what had happened was they realised that there was a bit of a race between us and the Russians to get to Peenemünde. And who got there first? The Americans. And virtually cleared them up out. But no, it really did get a real race on at that time. And there was, because the war was, you know, struggling to an end at the time. And I remember going across an airfield in Germany around about that time. And I was on one of the, doing second man on a Bedford 3-ton, which was the high ones. And Tony Pope was a pipe smoker. And he said to me, pitch black it was, and we could see these people moving each side of us. And he said to me, "Hey, Doug," he said, "have you got any matches on you?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, stick your hand out and ask one of these soldiers for a match." So they were quite high up. They were head high, these cab doors. So I said, "Okay." So I opened the back door and I said, "Open the side door." And I said, "You'd have to do without your smoke, Tony." So he said, "Well, I could have got all bloody jerrys that are marching each side of us." I said, "Don't say anything, just keep going." Anyway, all I could see was a sea of German helmets. So I thought, well, I'm not going to ask them for a box of matches.
Were they prisoners, or were they...
No, well, they were rich. It was a whole shambles at the end of the war. Some were giving themselves up and throwing their rifles away and doing all sorts of stupid things.
But these were, as far as you know, hostile.
No, they probably were. Or they didn't realise who we were. And they just thought they were marching alongside the wrong, you know, the wrong wagons. So anyway, that was what they could do.
What about when you got to Lübeck? That was after this dash up the autobahn.
Lübeck. Well, I with the tanks really. They said that they I wasn't up with the tanks at that particular time. They said disgrace themselves. They were shooting up the tram cars that were still flying their train along on the main road there. But then, as I say, it tailed off. We got into. It's either Peenemünde or Travemünde. There were two places very close together. And then they said, right, we're going up into Schleswig-Holstein now.
This is to Bredsted, is it?
To Bredsted. Now, I, for some unknown reason, I thought, well, this is going to be a lovely part of the country, and on solid and everything. And we went up there, and because it was in HQ squadron, we took over the small town of Bredsted.
Now, when had you been transferred to HQ squadron? Or was this when you were A1 echelon?
No, A1 suddenly fizzled out at that particular stage.
Right at the end of the war. Yeah. And so when were you transferred to their headquarters squadron?
Well, A1 always was headquarters.
That was it, right.
Yeah.
That was
so anyway, still in HQ squadron. So Stan was in the next village on the way up to that stage. And anyway, the surprising thing was that we moved in there, and it was a lovely village, and we took over one room in the village, right at the main, up towards the railway station, or the Bahnhof, or Eisenbahn, or whatever you call it. And there was, I was billeted in the village pub. There was a corporal, army catering corps, fellow in there that was bone idle, and it was made as odds and sods, and I was in the first floor. And the fellow that it was about the time they were doing the swap from flight and forces, first and second line. So a lot of our people, and they said, some of them they just transferred. The Scotch fellows just, you know, you think you're going to get a choice, you're not. So anyway, when it came to me, they said, and I said, I went down to see Stan, which was down the road, and I said, what do you think about me changing to the first line? He said, well, what do you think yourself? I said, well, I don't know, I'm a bit undecided. Well, he said, I know what I do. He said, sit tight, they'll send you somewhere. So after, and it wasn't until years after that I said, and that's from the influence, he said, I said, you had it made, didn't you? Going to the first line. And he said, volunteering for the first, he said, we didn't volunteer. He said, why didn't you come? Because, as you said, I didn't volunteer. I didn't realise that we were given an option. The idea was we were supposed to be transferred to the first line, trained up on Churchill's to drive these crocodiles, which was a
flamethrowers.
Churchill had flamethrowers. And then when we did that, we were supposed to be flown to the, eventually to the east coast of America. No, the west coast of America. And our Shermans would be, Churchill would be ready, and for landing in Japan. Well, then, obviously, and I said, you were all right, it fizzled out, you know, as soon as you got there. He said, well, it didn't quite fizzle out. I said, why? He said, we ended up in Greece. And it was a naughty little war. It was almost a civil war at the end of the war in Greece. That's where the first line ended. So we said it wasn't as cushy as what you thought. So, sorry, I missed it.